that's Detroit-born trombonist Curtis Fuller taking the lead with his quintet on Bluesette, the title track from his 1959 album. Fellow Detroiter Tommy Flanagan on piano, Jimmy Garrison on bass, Benny Golson on tenor sax, and Al Harewood on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, September the 11th, and the nation marks the 13th anniversary of a national tragedy. On the morning of Tuesday, September the 11th, 2001, 19 men, purportedly operatives of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda, split into four groups and boarded four passenger planes at different airports on a deadly mission to hijack the planes, redirect their flight plans, use them as explosive devices to crash into buildings that symbolize U.S. power, and cause as much loss of life, damage, and havoc as possible. Two of the planes, American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175, crashed into the north and south towers of the World Trade Center, and they collapsed. American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon, the headquarters of the U.S. Department of Defense. Its western wall collapsed. The fourth plane, on a redirected flight plan to Washington, D.C., crashed in a field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, after passengers attacked the hijackers and thwarted their plans. All the hijackers and 227 passengers died, as did 3,000 other people in the attacks. 343 firefighters and 72 law enforcement officers also were killed. PRN has done some extraordinary reports as recently as today on the 9/11 attacks and the mountain of questions that remain unanswered despite a commission of inquiry. I suggest you check the archives for these great programs. A different kind of tragedy is unfolding in Detroit, where residents are witnessing the collapse of their city and its assets distributed by design to the very institutions that they say are principally responsible for the awful mess that the city is in. Yesterday, the federal trial that's supposed to decide whether the state-imposed city manager's bankruptcy exit plan is fair declared a halt until Monday, so as to facilitate a deal in the making between Cincor Guarantee, one of the largest creditors, and the city. The reported terms of the deal have dealt a major blow to the people of Detroit, who were looking to the court for justice and fairness. None so more so than our guest today, Tom Barrow, one of the first voices raising the alarm that the city was being forced into bankruptcy and its purported $18 billion in debt simply isn't valid. And we welcome him today to the program. Tom Barrow is the owner of one of the largest minority-owned firms in the Midwest in accounting. He has been the chairman of the board of the of Michigan's State Board of Accountancy, and again, the first one of the first voices in Detroit to question the notion that the city was in fact in bankruptcy or veering toward bankruptcy because of an onerous debt. And thank you, Mr. Barrow, for being with us today.
Beatrice, it's a delight to spend the afternoon with you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, when we talked yesterday, you said your heart was heavy. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I think what I meant when I made that statement, having been born here in Detroit and having been raised here in Detroit and still living here and raising my family here and my businesses here, I'm able to see things from a unique perspective. Because my background is finance, I understand what's going on. I understand the what should be the precursors leading up to what should be going on. And why my heart is heavy is because what I am witnessing here, and I don't feel that it should be sugarcoated, but what I'm witnessing here is a bigotry and a racial animus that's manifesting itself using a phony, contrived bankruptcy to effectively take away everything that African Americans controlled, and blacks, I should say, and not so much the African American aspect, but blacks, and even well-meaning just regular Detroiters control, and transferring that wealth. And they're doing it using this phony bankruptcy that never should have occurred in the first place. And Detroit was not a proper candidate for it. It was forced on them. And what we're seeing, and why I am so disturbed and sad, is we're seeing a major transfer of everything that the city owned. Everything. Now, folks who are living in other cities may find it difficult to relate to, but let's take some of the larger cities who have their own zoos, their own convention centers, their own art institutes, their own water system, their own human services department, their own garbage pickup, their own lighting systems that they controlled, and their own bus systems that they controlled. All of that, and much more, is being taken away from has been taken away from the people of Detroit during the course of this bankruptcy, which was contrived. It was, and the passing off of these assets that disturbs me, Utrecht, is being done by people who were never elected, who are not accountable to anybody, and who don't really even live here. They're sent in from the outside, and so it does bother me because I know it's contrived, and I tried to sound the alarm after my meetings last year that this is where this is going. They want the city's assets. It's a redistribution of wealth from a black Democratic city to extreme conservatives who will then fund those same conservative causes, and right out of the playbook of the Legislative Exchange Council and the Mackinac Policy Center and the Koch brothers. This is right out of the playbook, and it's very disturbing.
To your mind, is a crime being committed here?
In my view, I believe that because this was all unwarranted in the first place and is contrived, but it's being done by your government, but I believe that that there is something wrong here that I think could very well have been criminal if a sincere investigation were to occur underneath all this. You will see that there was plotting and conniving well in advance of this by our elected leaders, our governor, and some of the others and henchmen underneath him to bring this bankruptcy about. This is not coincidental. This is part of a plan, and therefore, because it is part of a plan, people conspired to do this. Now, will they admit that? No, because why would they admit that if they don't have to? They're getting everything they want. Everything they want. This latest deal with Cencora and the FGIC. This whole deal with Cencora is the transfer of more of the city's assets. And you know what? As Cencora started out at 6 cents on a dollar, now with just the fundamentals of the next deal, they're up to 26, nearly 30 cents on the dollar. And with the assets that they're giving, which are revenue-producing assets, they're going to be right back to where they were over the course of time. They will not have lost any money. This is just a transfer of wealth from this poor black city and all these people who are the blacks who live here. And those who don't think it's racially motivated, you're just naive. You don't want to see what's obvious. Those who don't think that there is something underneath this that's beyond the finance aspect, you're either naive or you just got your blinders on and you don't want to see it. To me, the bigotry is palpable.
Well, let's go to that subject directly. The Cencora guarantee agreement. The judge, Stephen Rhodes, hearing the case being made before him now, is the final phase that would hopefully, at least from the city's point of view, gain the green light for a rather draconian bankruptcy exit plan. And the major opponent was Cencora, a bond insurer out of the city of New York. Cencora had opposed the plan, saying that the offer of the city, the initial offer of 6 cents on the dollar, was just not going to work. Then the city upped it to 10 cents on the dollar. They objected also to that. And miraculously, it was announced that there is a tentative deal in the works. The judge suspended the trial until Monday, the 15th. And we're learning the details of this so-called deal. Could you walk us through what the tentative deal reportedly is?
Yes, sure. Cencora Guarantee, they are a business which guaranteed certain of the bonds. They're not even the largest one. The judge ordered Cencora and the city and the FGIC, which is the Federal Guarantee Insurance Corporation, to go back to the bargaining tables and hammer out a deal. The FGIC is actually almost 3.5 times bigger in terms of debt than Cencora. But the city would like to have Cencora on its side to push the FGIC. But both of them are similarly situated. But let me just tell you what the deal was. Cencora says, all right, what you give me, you're offering me 6 cents on a dollar. And they were complaining all along because they're sophisticated enough to know that this whole thing is contrived. So if they're going to be, you know, divvying up the assets, Cencora is saying, well, we want our piece of this because we know you got a lot of assets here because, you know, really, this whole thing was not warranted. So therefore, you have a lot of assets that you can distribute that you're not talking about. And so Cencora then, knowing and being as sophisticated as they are, started arguing about the Art Institute, which, of course, you know, that's into the billions of dollars of value. And of course, that's when they did this grand bargain business that that the state did, the governor did, to make it seem like you're helping pensioners. But in fact, what they were doing was a backroom deal to protect the Art Institute and the arts and to try to remove it off the table. Well, Cencora says that, no, we want more than 6 cents on the dollar. We're going to take your Art Institute. We want the art. Go sell the art. All the time, Cencora, knowing there's lots of assets over here we can get, but they're not going to be willing to want to give us those. But if we focus in on that art, we know they're going to get panicky. You know, the Gilberts, the Fords, and all the other folks, and all the big money folks are going to get panicky, and they're going to relinquish. So Cencora's worked out a deal that says, look, in return for we'll let the Art Institute go, you give us a lease on the where we own the Detroit half of the Windsor Tunnel for the next 20 years. So that means they're going to get, they're going to appoint their own, you know, whatever entity they appoint to run it, but it's really Cencora, which means that they're going to get the revenues from the international crossing for the next 20 years. Now, they may value that today at some number, but that's the revenues into 20 years, and there's no telling what that's liable to grow to be.
Now, the Detroit-Windsor tunnel, I just want to interject, is the tunnel that connects Detroit with Windsor, Ontario.
Always owned and controlled by the city of Detroit. Major asset. They're going to take that in this phony bankruptcy. Then they say, well, you know, not only do we want that, we're going to want your parking at the second or third largest parking structure in the city, but it's the one located in the mega growth section of the city where that's the revitalization section down in the entertainment district. So that's called the Grand Circus Park Garage, which will, of course, they want the revenues from that. Now, here's an asset that the people of Detroit paid for, built, constructed, run. Now they're going to transfer that asset to Cencora for the next 30 years. Well, Jiminy, 30 years, the revenues from that, you know, and it's growing, that means it's going to grow way beyond what its value is today, which means now Cencora is not going to wind up with 26 cents on the dollar or 30 cents on the dollar. It's going to be a lot more than that. And then they get huge credits towards Detroit real estate, some unnamed amount of Detroit real estate. Wow, and then undisclosed amounts of cash. Now, bear in mind, Utris, and those who are listening to this, you know, whether you want to make this abstract or not, this is very real. And you have to bear in mind that here's a city now that's never defaulted on any of its debt, never missed a bond payment, never missed an interest payment, never missed a payroll, never not paid over its withholding taxes to the federal government, never has done any of those things which are precursors to bankruptcy. It is only because this governor, who's a conservative, extreme conservative, and then the conservative legislature created something to then make it fit. They tailored it. They tailored it for black communities. Every black city that's in Detroit of any size has been taken over, and all of their assets have been transferred and sold. And you can't just pretend like this is not race-based. It is race-based. And it makes my heart heavy, because I could never hate somebody that much to do this and to take that, which I know no mayor, to those listening, no mayor of a city would willingly relinquish all of its major assets, from the convention center all the way down to the parking departments, the lights, the water. The water is probably a $40 or $50 billion asset. They just transferred it yesterday. And they're going to give the city some nickels, in essence. $50 million a year to help folks who can't pay their water bills. That's not only is it demeaning, but it's a major ripoff of an asset, a $40 billion or greater amount asset.
But all of this is happening within the court. And it is hard to make the case that something so illegal as you maintain is actually being condoned by the court. I mean, it's there, it's opening, it's in the open, the trial is happening publicly, and all of these things are happening publicly, and therefore they all have the color of authenticity and legality.
That's the way these things work. I don't think that the bankruptcy court, you see, once the city brings it into the bankruptcy, once the city files bankruptcy, and it wasn't the city, bear in mind, it was this outside unelected person who then drags the city and puts them into this bankruptcy thing, because that was the plan to be able to do that. Once you put them into that, and the city didn't meet the criteria, the judge said it at the outset, the people who put them into it realized that they didn't meet the criteria and then started missing these payments, started making these mistakes and doing these things which would make it fit. So the once they do that, and you put them into that situation, the courts have no alternative except to now bring it forward and to start to discuss and to resolve and deal with things. You know, the city was under, its water department was under oversight due to the Clean Water Act for probably 40 years. Now, it's been under that. All of a sudden now, for the first time ever, they decide it doesn't need the federal oversight, and it gets relinquished miraculously. The police department, under consent decree, all of a sudden, for the first time, it was all manipulated to get it to this. And I guess I don't think the courts are complicitous in terms of being, I think it's in the court system, and they have to deal with it in the fashion of a bankruptcy. And if the only people who are presenting their positions and who control the data and the information are telling you one thing, and you don't get an alternative position because they've got an agenda. So you can make it look like whatever you want to make it look like. If you're into numbers, you can make it look like that. And there's no alternative because the data is controlled by a certain people.
Well, numbers are what you're all about. You are a CPA. You headed up the state agency that licenses CPAs in the state of Michigan. Numbers are your world. Why did you insist in the first instance that the numbers just were not adding up here to the claim by the then state-imposed city manager that the city of Detroit was actually in huge debt and bankruptcy would be the only way to protect it and to put it back on solid footing?
Let me say this. And I think if I analogize it so that folks at home and listening to this can put this into their own situation. Rule 101 in finance, long-term debt does not create a short-term emergency. It just cannot. It's tantamount to a person who has a home that costs $200,000 and they're paying, you know, $1,500 a month, and they have a job that makes it so they can easily pay their $1,500 a month. And then somebody comes along and says, well, look, you have, you know, you owe $250,000, and you don't have $250,000 in the bank to pay that off. So therefore, you're not handling your affairs right, and we're going to now remove you from your affairs. Well, that's what they did here. Well, the reality is, well, we never expected to pay it off tomorrow. We expected to pay it off over 30, 40 years. And that's what's happened here. And I knew that this was going on. And what really put me onto it, Utrecht, that something was happening here, is when the former mayor kept waving the flag and crying wolf that we're going to run out of money in October of 2012, I believe it was. And when I would look at the financial statements, and when I would look at the cash flow projections and the cash forecasts, I couldn't see where we were running out of money. But I'm thinking, like everybody else, you tend to want to believe. And then a month or so later, after this draconian call for we're running out of money, he says, well, it looks like we're going to have enough money now to get us through the end of the year. Well, wait a minute. Just a few weeks ago, a couple weeks ago, you were broke. Now he says, well, we're going to run out at the end of the year. I looked at the projections through the end of the year. I'm looking, it doesn't appear like that. So I'm starting to say, well, that's not the case. I don't think we're going to run out of money. And sure enough, he comes in December and says, looks like we're going to have enough money now to get us through the next summer. That then let me know that they're contriving something here. So we had a meeting with the state treasurer, one of the city council people, and they brought all of the city council people in one at a time, but this council person, Joanne Watson, asked me to accompany her, and she did not tell them who she was bringing, just that she was bringing somebody with her to listen and to advise her. And when I showed with this meeting with the state treasurer, his face just about fell on the floor, because of course he knows who I am. And when the first thing he asked was to her was, what four things do you want in return for you cooperating with an emergency manager? Now, this was at a time when the emergency manager wasn't even contemplated and the city was still in during negotiations. So it was clear from his conversation that this was being, the railroad was running. And she became incensed and said, we want the money that you owe us for the various things that have been agreed to between the state and the city. But then it turned over to me for me to ask specific questions. And so I did. I asked him, what is the objective here? And he says, well, we want to redo the balance. We want to rework the balance. Well, to me, that's vague. That doesn't mean anything. To lay people, that may be substantial. And he said, you know, because I've heard these numbers, I've thrown out these huge billion-dollar numbers, multi-billion-dollar numbers. And when I asked and started drilling down, it became clear that it wasn't the debt at all. They wanted the assets. They wanted the pension. They wanted to be able to privatize garbage. They wanted to be able to transfer things of value, the water system. When I asked them about us running out of money, and they made us borrow money under the old mayor, who was really just inept and way over his head, but they knew that. They knew that. It became clear that we never used the money that they made us borrow. And it's still sitting up there in a pot at the time. And yet you use that as your ostensible reason to rally the public troops, so to speak. And then when you have the media, who don't know themselves, but they just repeat what they're being told, they wind up creating an atmosphere and a juggernaut. But it became clear to me that this state treasurer, during the course of our conversation, he acknowledged that we're not going to run out of money. He acknowledged that the mortgage market, which the credit default swaps and derivatives, which drove down the entire country, that we had gotten out of it, and that we would never have those losses again in the pension. So when I heard all that, Utrecht, I'm convinced now, and looking at the financial statements, I don't look at the numbers, I look at the footnotes, I became convinced this is contrived. It's contrived. They've got an agenda here, and this agenda is the transfer of the city's wealth.
In following this story, we've come to learn that just about every predominantly African-American city and town in the state of Michigan currently is under emergency management. And one would assume that exactly the same protocols are being followed, the transfer of assets to unknown entities, and the end result being that these communities are being systematically eviscerated. What is your view?
Well, I think you've just described it. I think your perception is correct. Let's just take a few of the very large black cities here. Benton Harbor. It has been decimated. Its assets have been sold off. Everything has been privatized. The city has left a shell of itself, a shell. Every major asset gone. Pontiac, the city of Pontiac, privatized. It's police, it's public services have all been privatized and outsourced. Its major assets have been sold off. City of Flint, another black enclave, privatized. Major assets sold off and transferred. And I just go down the list of them. It is them finding black cities. They can create the problem themselves. You see, because if the state cuts revenue sharing, for example, as they did here in Detroit, they cut revenue sharing substantially. Then, as you are aware, money that comes from the federal government doesn't come straight into the city in all respects. Some of it goes up to the state and then down to the city. But when it comes time for it to come down to the city, they don't send it right away, which means you dry up your cash. Because you've incurred the bills, you've incurred the costs, but the people who have your money are not letting you get your money. So what you wind up having to do then is make transfers from other funds, from other departments that have money, and you wind up transferring money. And that's what the former mayor did. He wind up because of a lack of acumen, and many of these folks, because of a lack of acumen, don't know how to. You really have to face these things head on and get what you got coming. So the state creates the problem in all these cities. They cut their revenue sharing. And when I asked the treasurer, well, you know, revenue sharing, you've cut it, but now with the economy having turned around, your revenue sharing should increase back to its routine levels. And he agreed that it would. But they don't give it any effect in this. It never gets talked about. So here we have tens and twenties of millions and greater amounts of millions of dollars coming from the state that will now fire back up. But these smaller cities can't sustain. So they create the problem. They dry up your federal money, they dry up your state money, and then they tell you that you got debt. Well, yeah, so we got debt, but we're still making our payments because we have the cash reserves. No, they don't tell that story. Instead, they want the assets. So every black city, and I just named three of them, but if you just go down the list of them, you know, E-Course, the cities that are any of color, I mean, it's what's happening. They just go into them and take them over and sell off everything that they got.
Now, is this unique to Michigan, or is this happening, to your knowledge, in other parts of the country?
It's unique to Michigan. Michigan had a law, Public Act 72, which said that if a city gets into trouble, financial trouble, that the state can then send down somebody to do a review of it. Now, that gives a lot of power to the state because it's an arbitrary review based upon the city can either ask for them to come and do a review or the state can decide that, you know, we need to send somebody down to do a review. The people of the state of Michigan, seeing its draconian effect and seeing that then you would have an unelected person running a city, decided that we did not want Public Act 72. Look at the Detroit public schools. It was in the black. And then they sent in this emergency manager who has eviscerated the schools, transferred all the students into charters and private schools, taken public dollars to fund those private schools, and then tell you, because all the debt is left inside of the public schools. But you just gave away all the assets to these privates and then sent your business across the street to those private schools, and now you start crying that you can't pay your bills. Well, no, because you just took all my revenues away. And they decimated the school system the very same way. The schools in Ecorse, the schools in Pontiac, the schools in Benton Harbor. They just do it all across the board every place. And the reality is that it's a decimation that's occurring wholesale in the black community, and with the complicity, quite frankly, of some African Americans, some black folks, because they don't know, they're over their heads, and they want to believe, and they want to be liked, and they want to be loved, and so they go along. They want the adulation of certain people that makes them feel good. I guess we had that during slavery too, but it just makes them feel good to be liked like that. And at the same time, you're selling off your birthmark, your birthright.
When we take a look at the cumulative effect of this, again, going back to your proficiency with numbers, what are we looking at in terms of loss of gains over centuries, or certainly in the last several decades? People who moved from the South and settled in Detroit and in other small towns and cities in Michigan, built communities there, moved into the arena of self-governance and so forth. What is the cumulative impact and effect of what is happening now under this law that you just discussed?
Throughout the state of Michigan, got hundreds of thousands of signatures to repeal the law. And then the conservative governor, then in just days before it was to expire, before the end of the year, created another law identical to the one that they just repealed by circulating the petitions, had the legislature pass it, and then made it so repealed by a petition of the people. They were going to put this into place. Now, what's the effect of what all this has done? Well, of course, people come up from the South. They built Detroit. When everybody else was leaving, blacks stayed. They remained in the city. They kept the city alive. They stayed. And as the mortgages started, and this is what's, if people will just think about this for a moment themselves, in the 2005 through 2008 period, the banks were making loans, and people would take out these loans, and they'd send these brokers out, and all these mortgage brokers would go out and start selling these things, and people would do it, and people would pay their mortgages. They were fine in Detroit. They were fine paying their mortgage. When the mortgages reset, because the brokers told them, well, you know, in 2-3 years it's going to reset, but you'll just be able to refinance it. So people believed that. Blacks believed it. And 2-3 years comes by, and it's time to reset it, and now the mortgage payment kicks way up, and so they want to refinance it to get back to the good rate again, and the banks wouldn't do it. Why wouldn't they do it? Because behind everybody's back, they were securitizing those mortgages. They were bunching them together, and they created default swaps. It sounds like a lofty-sounding word, but it's nothing more than taking a bunch of mortgages, people who they knew could not pay the new rate, and then each person who sold it, each bank that sold it, insured it to the next bank, insured it to the next bank, and so on and so forth, leaving the final mortgage holder to be the AIG, which is the government. And when it all came collapsing down, and they wouldn't rework these people's mortgages and let them, they put them out their houses. Now, what do you have? You put them out their house, a perfectly good house, a person was paying on, was living there. You wouldn't work with them. You put them out. Now the house sits there. Of course it's going to atrophy. Of course, you know, someone's going to go inside and take the plumbing. And what's going to happen is you kill the neighborhood. And when you kill that neighborhood, now somebody else moves out because they lost their house. And now that house sits there, and then somebody sets it on fire. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, I guess is what I'm saying. And it's so hurtful. And that's what hurts my heart about Detroit, because none of this had to happen. This is all contrived. And now when they're done, when they're done taking and they've got the skin and all the bone and all the meat off the bone, they'll leave us in charge of probably the police because, you know, they want us to be able to arrest one another. But that's about it. And our black leadership, I'm just floored the complicity that I see of our black leadership. It's not like the days of what we know or what I knew growing up, wherein you had black organizations, NAACP, Urban League, and all these others who would stand up to these things. It's not like that anymore. There is no black heroes.
Some would say that as awful as the situation is, as mercenary as these corporations seem to be, that in effect is what corporations are and what they do. They look out for their best interests, and it is a matter that Detroit presented a fantastic opportunity for them to make money, and that's all that they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Do you see anything beyond that?
No, I see that precisely. But they needed to, it needed to be abetted by this law that is draconian, that it does not exist anyplace else in that form, that allows this unelected. But what it does is it allows the conservatives to control the whole calculation. So the conservatives will then send the folks in to take over the city. They'll put their person in place. They'll put a black face on him. We got a black face here doing it. But he's a conservative, an extreme conservative. And they had secret meetings with him all the time. They're telling us that they weren't meeting with him. It turns out they were meeting with him privately. But they'll put a face on it, and they'll send blacks to stand up and to speak to other blacks and to tell them, you need to do this. This is for your own good, while they're all enriching themselves. That's the way that is. And corporations are going to do what corporations do. But if you had an elected mayor, if you had a leader, you know, who was from your community, he would never permit it. She would never permit it, because they would see where it's going. And this is something that could easily have been avoided. Could easily have been avoided had you had a chief executive who was from the city and who cared about the city. We don't have that now. We don't have that.
Well,
now.
I might as well touch on this. You ran for mayor. Was this part of what it is you saw coming to Detroit?
I did. I did see it. And I will tell you, Utris, I believe this with all my heart, based upon what we saw when we performed our recount, where, you know, and when the first guy who did this, the city had 44,000 absentee ballots cast. There's only a 9,000 vote difference. 44,000 absentee ballots were cast. None of them could be recounted, because the seals on the cases had been changed. That's 44,000 votes could not be recounted because the seals on the cases had been changed, and another 19,000 at the polls. 52% of the vote that elected that particular mayor who facilitated this and who set this up, 52% of the vote couldn't be recounted. Just as early as last year, a handwriting expert said that of the write-in person, who we have a Caucasian mayor now, who won on a write-in, got more than almost 50%, got more than 50% of the vote in a write-in. And when we had the handwriting specialist look at it, over 40% of the ballots have been written in the same hand. Now, we're going to ignore that. Because why? Because it would call the system into question. So it's easier to make whoever's telling this into the bad person rather than looking into the system. There should have been somebody to look into this and to investigate it. And the reason why it's not is because the elections are controlled by the very people who are on the ballot. The elections are ran by the city clerk, who's on the ballot, the mayor, who's on the ballot, and the council president, who's on that ballot. There should be an independent commission. It's not good. But, you know, I'm fine with that. I'm not there, and I'm fine with that. But I tried to tell folks what was going to happen, because it was pretty obvious to me.
One would assume that if ordinary citizens can put the pieces together, well, you're not an ordinary citizen, you have a particular expertise in this area. But I'm talking about most of the people I talk to would consider themselves regular citizens, with you know, just regular everyday familiarity with the way things work, and they could sense massive wrongdoing occurring.
Yeah.
It is hard to imagine that no legal entity, no overarching entity, no regulatory agency, for example, looking at the banks, even though these matters were raised in court in the context of the lawsuit, that the banks were shown to have basically engaged in predatory and conspiratorial crimes. We've seen, you just talked and alluded to, massive fraud in voter elections and so forth. And one would assume that something might have come to the notice of a federal agency with the power and authority to initiate an investigation, because we're talking here about the confluence of so many things going wrong. Institutions misbehaving, the political power structure apparently engaging in rather questionable practices, the wholesale violation of people's constitutional and voting rights, just the nature of life, the quality of life in places like Detroit and Flint and other black cities, that these things could not just simply be coincidental. Why is it that these situations have been allowed to exist and deteriorate to this point without any intervention, it seems, from any high regulatory authority?
You know, let me say this, Utrecht. You alluded at the very outset of what you just said, that ordinary people, you know, everybody's got common sense. Ordinary people's common senses were telling them that something's not right, because it seems like ordinary people can never win. They're always on the wrong side when it comes time to win. They're watching the banks, for example, who were really the ones who caused much of the malaise that we're facing here in Detroit. They were presented as if they were such great people, and then it turns out that they're having to pay tens of billions of dollars in fines because they had engaged in predatory practices, which led to the sinking of the entire American economy. And no banker has gone to jail, but if it was ordinary people, of course they would have. Why is there not some investigation? Because in the particular instances that we're talking about, in the local city, and I think the facts are there, why they wouldn't look into it, the answer that I'm told is, well, there was no federal candidate on the ballot. You know, this was a municipal election. Well, and that should be handled by the state and by the local election commission. Well, the local election commission is composed of the very people who we were saying were engaged in the malfeasance. And frankly, some of whom we caught. Because we put leaves behind the door, and they swore that no one had been in the room, and then it turned out we had it filmed that they had in fact been there and it had in fact engaged. But why would they not investigate? Why would they not look into that? I can't give you the answer to it, because what we're seeing is so stark and so obvious, but it is so foreign to people's minds that in America these things could occur, that in fact you could have a major city like Detroit who may have debts. So what do you have debts? You have revenues and you have assets that greatly outweigh the debt. And the debts are being paid over the course of decades, if not a half a century. Not tomorrow, but they used it as if it's tomorrow. And that's the way they drove a truck through a pinhole. And then by having it repeated by the local media, who doesn't know themselves, they just repeat what they're being told. And when you go to the bankruptcy court, the judge has to do what's put in front of him. He didn't bring the case. Somebody else brought the case. But the person who brought the case wasn't an elected official.
But certainly the judge also has the authority and the obligation to investigate. He's not just there to hear a case. He's also acting as a, quote, jury in a way. And part of the charge of a jury would be also to take on an investigative aspect to the case. And especially when you are getting signals in the court itself that there are some conflicting things happening here that warrant closer investigation.
I think Judge Rhodes, he was suspicious of this, and I think he voiced it at the outset of this but the courts don't have the power to investigate. That's the agencies that have to do it. I don't think that there's been something presented to the courts in this that would suggest that there was any criminality or anything. Of course, the city would never present that.
Let's take the basic premise, and I'm going back to your basic premise. Let's take the basic premise. Part of the judge's responsibility in this case is to determine whether, in fact, the claim of $18 billion in debt is a valid claim. Now, it seems to me that there were more than enough hints that people are contesting that claim. But the judge didn't seem to want to entertain even the idea that the $18 billion could possibly be invalid or contrived, as you said.
Let's go even more rudimentary than that. Before you bring a city into a bankruptcy, into a Chapter 9 bankruptcy, there are benchmarks which have to occur that make you eligible for bankruptcy. It would seem that the very first question would be, before you start dealing with the meat of what's being placed and what everybody's arguing back and forth, is what are those criteria that the law says? And now let's go through those criteria one by one and show me where you met this criteria. Well, did you miss any bond payments? No. Well, that's a criteria. Did you miss any interest payments? No. Well, did you fail to make your payrolls? No. Well, did you fail to pay over the withholding taxes from your payrolls to the federal government? No. Well, are you insolvent in that your assets are less than your liabilities? No. Well, you don't meet the criteria. Why are we?
Well, that's the point. So why would the trial continue beyond just those questions being asked and determined?
Well, I can't give you the answer to that, because to me that seems to be so obvious that we never met the criteria. And then what happened is, once we're in the bankruptcy, Mr. Orr starts meeting those criteria. He then starts missing these criteria. And now we can't. Now we're not paying the bondholders. Now we're not paying over the taxes. Now we're meeting the criteria. But that's when we're in it, not antecedent to it, but when we're in it. Just something.
And that's my point. And that's exactly my point. This should signal to the judge, and this is what I refer to as the investigative nature of what the judge's role should be. First, you have rules by which, and you just enumerated them. How does a city qualify for bankruptcy? The city says, well, we have $18 billion in debt. Then the judge says, now show me. And the city can't. But then suddenly there are things that appear to be in line. That should trigger something in line with what the criteria are for bankruptcy. That should trigger an astute judge a question about how is it that it wasn't happening before, it never happened all these years before, and all of a sudden we're seeing these patterns emerging.
Yeah.
I am suspicious of these patterns.
Yes.
But we're not getting
that
from the judge either.
Because I think your common sense, like the common sense of many people here in Detroit, look at, for example, on the pensioners, Utrecht, I got to tell you this. They have this thing called a clawback, where they go back and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, pensioners are told, you owe, some folks owe as much as 80, 90 grand of back pension payments that you shouldn't have gotten. Well, look, they go back to, they say, look, for everybody who retired after 2003, you have a clawback, you owe money. Now, let's just, for just a moment here, very quickly, 2003, going for anybody who retired 2003 afterwards, you owe this massive sum of money. when, of course, people are on pensions, they're just barely making ends meet. So now all of a sudden, now you're going to take back a big chunk of that pension out of, big chunk of my money out of, out of my pension payments. Well, 2003, people usually work 30 years before retiring. What happened 30 years before 2003? The black mayor, the first black mayor was elected, Coleman Young. And what happened after that? City government opened up to blacks. So then those people are retiring now, 2003 and after. Who are they getting this clawback money from? Poor blacks. They didn't go, how do you come with an arbitrary January 1, 2003? And now what happened to the person December 31st, 2002? No, they don't owe, but the 2003 do. Why? Because that's when Coleman Young, 30 years later, blacks are retiring. 30 years later, blacks are working in the city in large numbers. The same is true of the school system. The very same is true. The two largest employers of minorities, they decimate. Well, what happens? You turn upside down a community. And this is so obvious as to what they're doing and their criteria and how it's been deliberately contrived to have the impact on the folks it's having the impact on. It's just not good, and it's just very, that's why my heart is heavy, because I feel bad. I feel so terrible. I feel so terrible because our city is in a malaise and a perception of it that is unwarranted. And now what they're doing now is moving folks out. It's a wholesale turnover. And you're going to see it in other cities. Detroit's the template. If it can happen here.
I've used exactly that word so many times. Detroit is a template for what's to come in many other cities.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Tom Barrow, for coursing us through this aspect of the bankruptcy.
Sure.
It is, in fact, a major tragedy that is occurring before our eyes and without interference from any authority that should be involved in the interest of justice. We see a hands-off position, and basically people are saying, well, let it happen. It's just Detroit. It's just black people. No big deal.
Yeah.
They'll deal with it. And if not, well, they'll deal with that. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I would like to call you back because there's so much that you know from your perspective as a numbers person, a person who understands this, a person who has been involved in major bankruptcies, handling major bankruptcies. You know what the court system is like, and you know what the process is like. And I'd like to call on you again very soon to course us through the next leg. After the 15th, we'll see what happens when the judge reconvenes this so-called trial.
It would be my privilege to help you out in that respect. And I just want folks to know that you have to be vigilant in your communities, and you'll have to stand, because these folks, they want what they want, and they will kill whatever they want to kill to be able to achieve it. So, Utrus, I'm delighted to have been able to spend the afternoon with you.
Thank you so much. Same here.
All right.
Well, as we come to the close of our program, you may wonder, well, what happened to the speech? Well, the speech is our topic tomorrow. The president's speech last night will be the conversation we will have with each other tomorrow, the analysis. We'll use the Free Your Mind Friday time to concentrate on the great speech. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I hope this program was useful to you in opening up your eyes about what is happening in Detroit, not as a story of Detroit, but as a story that is coming to a community near you. You need to understand this is how America is being experienced and lived by millions of people every day. The same country that talks about guaranteeing democracy and freedom to people abroad can't deliver it at home. And we have this conspiracy going to deny people their right to just a decent life and to unfairly burden them just for racist principles, to burden them with these kinds of onerous debts and misery. which is just not right. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Occupied Territory, America with Mike Fader. Drop me a note. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your esteemed company. Bye-bye.